Hadlines: Russian forces continue their push towards Kiev, with Ukraine's President Zelensky saying the war is now at a strategic turning point. The Red Cross pleads the world not to forget the people of Yemen as the global attention shifts towards the conflict in Ukraine. Also ahead, the United States is shutting down Afghanistan's embassy, giving diplomats 30 days to ask for humanitarian parole or face deportation. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. To Ukraine now. We're beginning with, of course, a developing story in Ukraine. President Volodymyr Zelensky says his country has already reached a strategic turning point in the conflict with Russia and is moving towards victory. Zelensky says he does not know how many days it will take to, quote, free Ukrainian land, but they will do it. The president has rallied Ukrainians with a series of addresses from Kiev since the conflict began on February 24th. He has received support from other European states and the U.S., which have provided Ukraine with money and arms. They have also imposed tough sanctions on Russia, but turned down Zelensky's main demand, that is a no-fly zone over Ukraine. Western countries say they do not want to directly engage in war with Russia. The EU has also dismissed Kiev's fast accession to the bloc. The online video sharing platform YouTube says it is blocking access globally to media funded by the Russian government. The American platform says the decision is in line with its policy of barring content that denies, minimizes, or trivializes violent events. Earlier this month, YouTube also blocked leading Russian channels RT and Sputnik across Europe amid Russia's military operation in Ukraine. Meanwhile, the American company Meta, which owns Facebook and Instagram, says it is allowing posts that call for violence against Russian forces. In response, Moscow says it is restricting access to Instagram and has launched criminal proceedings against its parent company. The United Nations has also warned that the anti-Moscow move could spark hate speech against Russians. Former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer Scott Bennett explains how Western media are engaged in a propaganda campaign backed by their governments to deceive the public about what's going on in the world.
Well, everything that you're watching on Russia Today and Sputnik and Press TV as well, these are the sources of truth. These are the source of accuracy. This is the real revelation of what is going on in the ground. You can't believe anything that is coming out of the Western media. So Americans are starved for truth. That's why they have been deceived for 20 years into these endless wars, because of the propaganda that has been forced upon them from their own CIA that manipulates these big tech companies. So we're seeing big tech and the political implosion in America and this emerging deep state just suddenly start coming apart. America has now been caught with evidence of crimes against humanity, bioweapons, violation of international treaties. I'm glad to say the suggestion that we made on Press TV, the Russians have followed. They've actually went to the United Nations Security Council and are demanding investigations. And that, yet again, is another issue. The Americans are falling all over themselves, and they're doing it with absolutely no grace. The Biden administration officials are desperate to lie. This is done by people who have lost, who are in the corner, that are wounded, and are about to be destroyed by the fire of their own lies.
Thank you.
Russia just needs to be very composed and say to the world, who do you believe, us and the facts and the evidence, or the liars who gave you 9/11 and 20 years of war against the entire world? And I think the world is going to come to the side of Iran and Russia. They just need time to see the truth.
The majority of Americans disapprove of President Joe Biden's performance, especially over his handling of the rising inflation in the country. That's what a recent poll shows. It was conducted by the Wall Street Journal. The poll found that 57% of respondents disapproved of Biden's performance. On the economy alone, 63% gave him a negative marks. Half of the respondents said inflation is a main concern for them. Only 42% approved of the president's job. Now, that is roughly the same percentage in a November survey. Rising costs have been a persistent issue for Biden in recent months, despite efforts to unclog supply chains. And now the ongoing conflict in Ukraine has exacerbated U.S. inflation. That is due to rising energy and commodity prices in the wake of sanctions on Russia. An international weekly has published a report on how Iran's resilience proved decades of crippling U.S.-led sanctions ineffective. The Economist calls instructive Iran's experience in the face of global pressure. It says that the Islamic Republic suffered recessions, devaluations, and chronic inflations due to the U.S.-led sanctions, but the country managed to save its economy from collapse. The first source of resilience, according to the report, is risky sanctions busting that enabled Iran to export hundreds of thousands of barrels of oil and other commodities per day. Iran's export diversification is the second source of resilience, and a third factor, the report says, is the country's import a substitution with homemade products. The Economist says that the result of all of those measures, Iranian manufacturers have prospered and the stock market has flourished. Iran has a new eye in the sky. This week, it put into orbit its second military satellite. As we will see in the next report, the latest achievement comes despite stringent sanctions against the country. The aerospace force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps successfully put a reconnaissance satellite into orbit this week. The Noor-2 was launched from Imam Khomeini Spaceport in Semnan Province. The satellite reached a low orbit of 500 kilometers above the Earth on an Iranian three-stage Qassid carrier, which used a combination of liquid and solid fuels. The Noor-2 became Iran's second military satellite successfully placed in low Earth orbit. Commander of the Space Command of the IRGC's Aerospace Force said Iran's national space and defense organizations, knowledge-based companies, and universities cooperated in the Noor-2 project. Brigadier General Ali Jafarabadi explained that the domestically manufactured satellite incorporates the newest technology. It is the upgraded version of Noor-1, which was launched into orbit 21 months ago. Data obtained by Iran's second military satellite can have multiple general and defensive uses. The Noor-2 will orbit the Earth every 90 minutes and will pass over the Iranian sky 16 times every day. Its mission will last at least 3 years. The commander explained that the IRGC will launch a series of Noor satellites in the coming years to consolidate its position in low Earth orbit before aiming for the orbit 36,000 kilometers above land. The latest achievements of Iran's space program came a few days after the IRGC unveiled two underground bases housing state-of-the-art missiles and attack drones. Iranian officials have congratulated the successful launch of Iran's second military satellite. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian praised the achievement, saying no sanction can block Iranian growth and progress. The IRGC says the latest success was another meaningful sign that Iran has defeated the enemy's sanctions.
Iran has been relentlessly developing new weapons and military equipment, arguing that it needs the means to defend itself in the world's most volatile region. Just weeks ago, the country unveiled a state-of-the-art ballistic missile with pinpoint precision. Khaybar Shekan boasts high maneuverability when it dives down, making it a nightmare for the world's most advanced missile shields. Iranians have stressed that their defense program grew out of the war initiated by Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. Saddam's forces showered Iranian cities with missiles and bombs provided by the East and the West, while Iranians say no one sold them any proper means of defense. Iranians argue that they have no choice but to build their own defense industry. The latest achievement strongly suggests that Iran's pursuit of robust defense capabilities is in full swing despite stringent American sanctions.
I think that these developments send several interrelated messages, the first and foremost being that Iran's technological development will not be held back by the obviously failed efforts of the United States and its allies to curtail Iranian technological development. It sends another similar message regarding sanctions, that sanctions are going to be completely ineffectual in terms of holding back Iran's scientific as well as industrial development.
Iran is still engaged in the negotiations in the Austrian capital aimed at removing the sanctions, but its defense industries are not waiting for the talks to end in an agreement. Observers believe Iran's launch of a military satellite into orbit, as talks in Vienna are still underway, is sending a clear message that it will never negotiate over its defense capabilities and that no agreement can ever restrict its defense, missile, and space programs. The Islamic Republic has made it clear that it will never ask for permission from anyone to manufacture its own means of defense.
The International Committee of the Red Cross warns that the world must not forget Yemen and other war-torn countries as the conflict in Ukraine grabs everyone's attention. The head of the Red Cross delegation in Yemen, Katharina Ritz, says that the Ukrainians must be added to all of the crises currently taking place, but the focus must not shift to European countries. She said that the world should not lose sight of the plight of those living through a years-long war in Yemen. Ritz added that people's duty is to equally help everyone in need. Earlier, the United Nations Children's Fund also warned of the situation in Yemen. UNICEF said that over 10,000 minors have so far been killed or maimed in the Saudi-led war since it began 7 years ago. 47 of these cases were recorded in the first 2 months of 2022. Earlier, we talked to a journalist based in Melbourne, Samuel Geddes, to find out what he thinks about the UN inaction on Yemen's humanitarian catastrophe caused by the years-long Saudi war there.
We've been constantly told how Yemen is on the edge of a famine or on the edge of a particular kind of humanitarian crisis. But of course, it has been at that stage of crisis for 7 years. From the figures that I'm aware of, the death toll is close to 400,000, and of course the vast majority of those will be civilians, and particularly civilians with particular nutritional needs, so young children, people with underlying conditions, and the elderly. And yes, I mean, nearly a decade of such acute food crisis, as well as you say, disruption to the educational system and every other system. Yes, this will, without being an expert on child health, I would definitely say that this is going to leave very long-term scars on Yemeni society and on its future social and economic development.
Yemeni armed forces say they have carried out a large-scale drone operation targeting Saudi Arabia's oil facilities.
Our armed forces carried out a wide military operation, the first break siege operation, using 9 drones. The targeting of the Aramco refinery in the Saudi enemy's capital Riyadh using Samad 3 drones, the targeting of Aramco facilities in Jizan and Abha and other sensitive locations using 6 Samad 1 drones.
The Army spokesman said the operation was a response to Riyadh's fuel embargo on Yemen. Sari says his country is ready to carry out more operations in retaliation to Saudi Arabia's aggression and its blockade. The Saudi state news agency cited a government official who confirmed that a refinery in Riyadh was attacked. On Thursday, the news agency, however, said the attack caused a small fire that was contained and the refinery's operations and supplies were not affected. People in Turkey have taken to the streets to protest a recent visit to their country by the Israeli President Isaac Herzog. Protesters gathered outside the Israeli consulate in Istanbul, slamming Turkish authorities for hosting the Israeli president. They dismissed the Wednesday visit as a betrayal of the Palestinian cause and the Islamic community. Herzog's trip was the highest-level visit by an Israeli leader to Turkey in 14 years. Political relations between the two sides soured following a 2010 Israeli attack on a Turkish ship that was part of a Gaza-bound aid flotilla. 10 Turkish nationals were killed as a result. In 2016, Ankara and Tel Aviv resumed full diplomatic relations after Israel agreed to pay compensation to the families of those who were killed. The United States says Afghanistan's embassy in Washington will shut down unless a recognized government in Kabul provides enough financial support to keep the lights on. Afghan diplomats working in the U.S. have now 30 days to apply for residency or temporary humanitarian parole before they risk being deported. That is according to the State Department. The diplomats were appointed by the former U.S.-backed Afghan government. Now they could be under threat by the ruling Taliban if they return home. The Taliban began their rule in August last year after toppling Ashraf Ghani's government and the exit of American forces from the country. Currently, an estimated 100 Afghans work at the country's embassy and consulates in the U.S. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The most recent example of the fulfillment of these needs is the people's presence in the 22nd of Bahman rally a few days ago. Today's 22nd of Bahman was astonishing. It was really a spontaneous move. It was really a spontaneous movement that people did, and it was really admirable. This move was truly praiseworthy. With the problems that surround the people, the coronavirus and the livelihood problems, on the one hand, the modest slinging of foreigners and the unfortunate contribution of some internal elements to the same modest slinging, on the other hand, and despite all these obstacles and problems, the people held a great rally. Those who record the population of the participants, and who can guess their numbers with cameras, and whose estimation is very close to reality, reported to us that in all but two or three provinces of the country, this year the population was larger than last year. In some provinces, the turnout was twice as much as last year. In some provinces, it was 40-50% more. It was like this everywhere. The people's move showed an astonishing vigilance. These are really admirable and meaningful moves. Well, these are examples of the people's recognition of present-day needs and of their voluntary and innovative moves.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
And there are certain issues that form the needs of the future. Many people identify them and carry out the necessary task, and some people show negligence about them. What I mean by future means is the needs that will make us hit rock bottom if we do not think of them and do not do anything for them now. If we do not think of them at present, we will face problems tomorrow. Training scientists and researchers is an example in this regard. If we do not train researchers today, and if we do not launch a great scientific movement, then in 15, 20 years' time, we will no longer have outstanding scientists capable of competing with the world or crossing the frontiers of science.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Early January, Ghanaians were pleasantly surprised to see the country's Speaker of Parliament, Alban Begbin dressed in traditional clothing instead of a ceremonial outfit with colonial links. He addressed Parliament on the reason for adapting Ghana's traditional attire.
We must create a unique set of values and norms that will give a unique character to our Parliament, to set it apart from the colonial legacies of the British system.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on a very commendable decision by the Speaker of Ghana's Parliament to dump decades-old cloak of the Speaker for traditional Ghanaian attire. This move is seen as a step towards the revival of the country's rich culture. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about the decision by Twitter to disable accounts of African activists opposed to United States imperialism. We are asking, why are the US-based social media giants intent on muzzling the voices of freedom in Africa? Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Ghana, back to the roots. The Speaker of the Parliament in Ghana, Alban Babin, fulfilled his promise of limiting the wearing of Western suits and gowns during sitting in the House. The Speaker ditched his ceremonial outfit for traditional attire for sitting in the House on January 25, 2022. He wore a traditional outfit with kente cloth and a crown worn by chiefs during ceremonies. The kente fabric comes originally from Ghana centuries ago and is one of the best known of all African textiles. The kente cloth subsequently became a symbol of Pan-African identity and a symbol of black pride.
Now, prior to wearing kente during his official parliamentary duties, Begbin urged members of parliament to promote locally made traditional outfits and market Ghanaian culture instead of wearing Western attire.
You will not be seeing me often again with that dress code, a suit, and that aristocratic cloak or gown. You may be seeing me more with traditional dresses. I may use that only for ceremonial occasions, which is what is in the literature of Ghana concerning that cloak and gown. It's for only ceremonial occasions. So those who know former speakers, you see former speaker Asiedu wearing a kente and a shirt. And that is what is the portrait we have today. And so we have to change all that. Well, we have to provide the market for our produce.
Now, for more on the move by Ghana's parliament speaker to adopt the country's traditional clothing, we contacted Jonathan Ofei Anso, Ghanaian journalist and commentator. He's also the publisher of Africa Briefing. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what's your initial reaction to the move by Ghana's parliament speaker to dump decades-old colonial cloak for the country's traditional clothing?
Well, I do applaud him, you know, for the step he's taken, because we are Ghanaians, and we have our traditions, we have our customs, we have our costumes. We've been independent for 65 years. So I see no reason why, you know, the parliamentary speaker should be donned in the colonial regalia with the wake. Look, even considering the weather, though the parliament is fully air-conditioned, still, it does not speak well, you know, of our culture, for our culture. You know, we have cultures, we have our own costumes. So I believe that the step he's taken, you know, should be applauded.
Ghanaians were clearly delighted by their parliament speaker for adopting the country's traditional attire. Many Ghanaians say the speaker showed the way in promoting the Ghana brand, and he urged the Chief Justice to emulate the speaker in ensuring that lawyers and judges are also permitted to dress in local fabrics in court. Can we say there is some sort of revival in the country and people are tired of colonial relics and want to return to their roots?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, judging by the reaction, you know, from Ghanaians, you know, generally within the country, I think, look, it shows how proud Ghanaians are of their heritage. Though I must say that we've been influenced a lot by Western cultural influences. But look, these days, when I was growing up, you know, in my teens, whatever, we all used to listen to soul music, reggae, you know, so on and so forth. But these days, when I go to Ghana, everywhere you go, especially the youth, you know, they all listen to Ghanaian music. Everywhere you go, it's Ghanaian music, Ghanaian music. So that should tell you that Ghanaians, you know, are at least the current youth, you know, the youth of today, the Ghanaian youth of today, appreciate more, you know, their culture than any Western influences.
The Ghanaian government has introduced the use of locally made Ankara fabrics as school uniforms in order to promote African prints.
The Speaker of Ghana's Parliament says his decision to adopt the Kente traditional attire goes in line with the aspirations of the first president of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah.
That this decision accords with some of the propositions of the first president of Ghana, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, and the other founding members of the Parliament of the First Republic. The dominant dress code of members of the National Assembly of Independent Ghana was native costume.
Now, what impact will the move to adapt African fabrics have on the youth in Ghana?
It's going to have a very, very positive impact. I recall about 20 or so years ago, the government did not rule, but set this trend on that every Friday, public servants should not go to work in Western attire. So these days, you go to Ghana, you go to the ministries, offices, whatever, you see men and women wearing traditional garments. The men usually wear shirts made from Ghanaian cotton prints.
The government of Ghana is also involved in efforts to promote local products and boost employment. The Made in Ghana initiative was developed by the Ministry of Trade and Industry to promote products made in this West African country. In his introductory remarks after deciding to wear the traditional attire, this is what Ghana's president said on the need to promote products made in the country.
This is the Parliament of Ghana. It's a unique Made in Ghana product. And we must showcase and market it to the world as a brand.
Can the move to traditional attire be replicated in other sectors to attain self-sufficiency and disentangle the country from dependency and neo-colonialism?
It's a mindset that not only Ghanaians, Africans in general, have this mindset that anything coming from abroad is better than what, you know, is being produced locally. Like, you take a vehicle, you take a computer, you take a mobile phone, I mean, name it. Even close, I mean, they think, Africans think that whatever is manufactured abroad in Europe, America, China, Asia is much better than what is produced locally. So it's a trend that's a mindset, but it will take a long time for this mindset to change. So what the government is doing now is a step in the right direction, but it's they are taking the baby steps. Okay, I mean, the school children wearing uniforms made from our own local fabrics, and so on and so forth, and so on and so forth. So by the time they grow to be adults, that culture will be ingrained, will be inculcated in them to move forward. So I believe that, look, it's a mindset. A mindset, it takes a long to change one's mindset. But I believe that Ghana and Africa will get there.
In Africa, dress provides a powerful tool to challenge neo-colonialism and is also considered an effective method of cultural expression and resistance. Now, additionally, a person's dress code can reveal dimensions of political and social transformations that cannot be discerned through verbal and written articulations. There is a movement now to drop colonial attire in African parliaments and judicial organs. Now, most countries in Africa still use clothing linked to cultural colonialism. Isn't it about time that African countries take serious measures to revive their cultural identity?
Well, you take Moscow, look, go to Nigeria and go to the Sahelian countries, you know, Niger, Burkina Faso, Mali, Guinea, Senegal, Gambia. Most of them wear the bubu, you know, the African bubu, you know. And you take the armed services, like they say, the police, the army, they wear uniforms, okay? I mean, it is convenient. I mean, a policeman cannot wear the traditional African garment. In Ghana, our very traditional, the men wear a cloth wrapped over the shoulder. A policeman cannot use that garment. Neither can a soldier. So that the uniform used by the security services, the army, the police, and so on and so forth, I think it's okay. But look, it will take a long time. We need to start from somewhere. Recently, the African Union officially adopted Swahili, the Swahili language, as an official working language for the EU. That is one step. So look, if you learn, you know your language, the more you know your language, the more you know your culture. So it will take some time, but I believe that eventually Africa will get there.
Thank you very much, Ofei and Sir, for your time and insight. Indeed, Africa is on the right path towards cultural revival. Now, we now take a short break, and our next subject will be on the crackdown launched by Twitter against African activists opposed to imperialism and neocolonialism. So stay with us.
Twitter crackdown on African activists.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
United States social media giant Twitter has disabled the accounts of several Ethiopians and Eritreans and their related groups without justification. Now, the accounts had recently helped promote the No More and Hands Off hashtags in the campaign against illegal intervention by the U.S. in the internal affairs of the two countries and other parts of Africa.
Amongst the disabled accounts was Horn of Africa Hub, a page started in October 2021 with over 18.8 thousand followers. This page described itself as combating false, deadly narratives about the Horn of Africa, including in Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea, Djibouti, and beyond.
Now, apart from the activities on Twitter, activists have also organized peaceful protests across the world to popularize the No More and Hands Off hashtags. There is one such protest in South Africa.
Actually, you know, these things happened the past 3 years, you know. We've been trying to solve out the things in back home, but still he's trying. Our Prime Minister, Dr. Abe, he's trying himself. But the thing is, the other opponent party, the TPLF, they don't want the leadership that he's running. And then they start to doing, they get support from U.S., actually. They get truly support from U.S. because the overseas news, the parties which is passing through CNN, BBC, the fake news that they produce for us.
Now, for more on the Twitter crackdown on online movement opposed to U.S. imperialism and neocolonialism, we contacted Hermela Ergawi, an Ethiopian-American journalist. Thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we have seen lies on mainstream media and crackdowns on the social media. What's your take on the crackdown by the social media giants against online activists?
Well, first, I think it's important to note that I was for a long time a part of the mainstream media. I worked for the CBS affiliate in LA, Al Jazeera America, which is pretty mainstream when it was launched here, as well as other local affiliates. So I'm very familiar with what the standards of mainstream media are supposed to be. And so I was really disappointed to find out that a lot of the reporting in the usual mainstream outlets like CNN, New York Times, was over time became very clear that it was not objective, that it was telling only this one-sided story, very much became propaganda. And so that's what inspired me to sort of move into this space and be a part of the conversation. And social media is the only way to really push back when you are reaching out to CNN and reaching out to outlets and saying, hey, this part of the story you guys are not covering over the course of months, then the only outlet you really have is social media. So we started the hashtag No More campaign to push back against a lot of the false narratives that were taking hold in the mainstream outlets.
Hashtag No More Movement started in Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa and then quickly spread out to other regions in Africa and beyond around the world and became a symbol of resistance against imperialism. In as far as Norway, Ethiopians and other diaspora Africans gathered to express their opposition to the US meddling in Africa.
TPLF is a terrorist organization. TPLF is a Trojan horse of United States. USA, learn from your mistakes. No to US invasion. No to US invasion in Ethiopia. No to US invasion in Eritrea. We stand for peace.
We stand for peace
in Ethiopia.
In Ethiopia.
We stand for peace.
We stand for peace
with Eritrea. Hands off Ethiopia.
Ms. Aregawi, can you elaborate more on what the No More and Hands Off hashtags are all about?
So hashtag No More was created in response to what was essentially government propaganda, U.S. government propaganda that was being told through mainstream media outlets about the conflict in Ethiopia. The mainstream narrative was that the Ethiopian government was trying to genocide the people of Tigray. Tigray is a region with ethnic Tigrayans, or largely ethnic Tigrayans, which make up maybe about 5% of the population. Both of my parents are from there, so I guess you would say I'm ethnically Tigrayan. So there is no part of me that wants to support a genocide against people of my ethnicity. And there isn't evidence to back that.
Twitter has taken down thousands of accounts in vast sweeps that sometimes claim to be targeting state-directed disinformation operations, but actually the objective is to clamp down on anti-US messages. Why are Western powers, especially the US, muzzling free African voices, especially Ethiopians, in social media platforms who are opposed to the TPLF rebels?
I really think the foreign policy right now is so extremely misguided. I don't think that this helps the U.S. at all. Honestly, the communities in the diaspora are trying to understand why is the U.S. betting on this group that they cannot rely on. This group is cannot even be relied on by their own people in the Tigray region who are essentially at this point held hostage, right? So it's really confusing because it doesn't seem productive, but the U.S. has taken the stance anyway.
The anti-war no more was a trending hashtag for weeks until Twitter blocked it. Now, despite the censorship by Twitter, this African campaign continues on social media platforms. Activists say that apart from Ethiopia, this campaign is also targeting U.S. interference in other African countries.
Ethiopians can govern their own affair. The United States should not be interfering in this, and that is why we are here. We say we are here to say no more Afghanistan, no more Syria in Ethiopia. Ethiopia can decide its own fate, and the interference that we see from Western countries is totally uncalled for, it's not necessary, and it should stop.
Over 100 million people are supporting the current government, and here in diaspora have a high support of what's going on in Ethiopia. So we're trying to tell the Biden administration don't interfere. Ethiopia is a sovereign nation. We can make decisions and should not be supporting the terrorist group who wants to come back to power again by force.
Now, Ms. Aregawi, do you think the U.S. and other Western powers will succeed in silencing the voices of Africans who say no more to imperialism and neocolonialism?
I do not think they will be successful in silencing the people that are rallying around no more. This is something that's been decades in the making. The frustration that people have didn't just pop up last year. This is something really deep that the people know really well. And so it's a matter of how the U.S. will respond. So will they evolve? Will foreign policy here in the U.S. evolve in how it's been dealing with the Horn of Africa and other parts of Africa? Or is it just going to stay down this road, destroy the relationships with those countries, and essentially push them in a different direction in terms of geopolitics and who they choose to ally with? And you do see that. There's some support from Russia and China in the Horn of Africa. And part of that is they, you know, the U.S. has just essentially pushed the people of that country in that direction because they continue to tell the propaganda of the armed terrorist group that has waged a war on the people of Ethiopia. So all these different groups can't be silent.
Twitter is now facing accusations of pursuing a destabilization policy in Africa. The Nigerian says the U.S. technology company is employing double standards and supporting the secessionists in the West African country.
U.S. social media giants have come under fire over misuse of their platforms to spread hate and incitement in conflict areas in Africa and elsewhere. Now, what's your take on that?
You know, like everything else, if you don't evolve, you die. So there are more than 1.3 billion people in Africa. Many of them are young. Over the course of the next decade or two, many of them are going to be using social media platforms. So if Twitter and Facebook does not become more culturally competent and hire people from the diaspora in different regions to get a better understanding of what is going on in those countries, then they will either intentionally or unintentionally be backing groups that are essentially behind violent elements in different countries. So in the beginning, I thought it was a context issue, even with the mainstream media. And then over time, when they had data that was countering what they were alleging and chose to ignore it, then it became clear that this was intentional.
Thank you very much, Ms. Haramela Aregawi, for your incisive analysis. Unfortunately, our time is up for today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, we shall keep our eyes on the anti-imperialist movement in Africa here at Africa Today. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Send us your comments through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a question that is often asked regarding one of the events that is popularly narrated regarding the day of Ashura. This is kind of tied up to the month of Sha'ban. We would like to congratulate our listeners on this most auspicious month, which is the month of Sha'ban, a very blessed month, a spiritual month, and a month of spiritual growth. It's also the month in which we have many holidays, the birth of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his magnificent brother, Hazrat Abbas, the birth of the 12th Imam alayhi salam. For this, we would like to offer our congratulations to our esteemed listeners. The question that's asked regarding the event of Ashura is whether or not there was actually water present on the day of Ashura. You know, some people say there was, some people say there wasn't. And so the question is asked and people are curious exactly what occurred on this day. Of course, we would like to add the reservation here that according to authentic historical accounts, there was water present until the eve of the day of Ashura. This is testified to by the fact that the son of Imam Hussein, Hazrat Ali Akbar, alayhi salam, said, "O father, my thirst has killed me or has tortured me." In order to respond to this question, we need to return to what's been related in reliable historical texts. According to a lot of reliable historical texts, Ibn Ziyad, Ubaydullah Ibn Ziyad, he gave the order on the 7th of Muharram to Umar Asad that he not allow Imam Hussein to arrive at the Euphrates River, and he didn't want him to even get a drop of water to drink. Umar Asad, when he received this order, he gave the order to Umar ibn Hajjaj to go with 500 horsemen and to watch over the Euphrates River, to not allow Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions to get to the river. In these 3 days, Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions tried in various ways to arrive at the river from other directions, because, as you know, you know, they were with children and women and in, you know, the desert, and it was very difficult for them to bear the thirst at this time. According to many other accounts which have been narrated, Imam Hussein also attempted to dig wells in his encampment in order to get water to drink. And when the news of such a thing reached Ibn Ziyad, he was upset, he became angry, and he also he ordered his soldiers to prevent Imam Hussein from doing such a thing. According to another account which has been narrated, it has been mentioned that the brother of Imam Hussein, Hazrat Abbas alayhi salam, performed a night mission along with 30 horsemen and 20 soldiers, you know, under the, you know, command of Nafi ibn Hilal, to arrive. They attempted to arrive at the Euphrates River to get some water. They became entangled with the army of Umar ibn Hajjaj, and but at the same time, they were successfully able to fill 20 canteens of water and bring them back. Of course, this hasn't been the exact time when this occurred, hasn't been related. Nevertheless, this is something that's been related. According to some other accounts, it has been related that on the day of Ashura, when Imam Hussein alayhi salam told his sister, Hazrat Zainab alayhi salam, that he was soon going to be martyred, his sister, she fainted, and Imam alayhi salam asked for water to be sprinkled on her face so that she could be revived. This account, you know, kind of conveys the idea that there was some water at least present on the day of Ashura. According to certain other accounts, even more water was present. And, you know, these different accounts should be taken into account in order to assess whether, you know, the presence of water or its absence on the day of Ashura. Thank you for joining us on The Key, where we're looking at the presence or absence of water on the day of Ashura. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Shia Muslims in Nigeria. Nigeria, a country in West Africa near the equator. A country with the largest population in Africa. The population is near 200 million people. Even though Nigeria is the largest economy in Africa and the richest man in Africa is from this country, poverty is evident everywhere in the nation. The vast uranium, gold, iron resources and oil reserves haven't reduced the pressure of poverty on the people and have failed to bring welfare and peace for them. Nigerian people have strong religious beliefs. On Sundays, the Christians form congregations of tens of thousands of people and go to churches. Muslims, who form the majority of the population in the country, learn about religious teachings from childhood. In Zaria, a city north of Nigeria, a Muslim teacher lives. Our story is about him.
My name is Zina Ibrahim, Zinatuddin Ibrahim, and I'm from the Islamic movement, and the wife of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. I was born in Zaria, Nigeria, the city of Zaria, and I did my primary school and secondary school in Zaria. And when I was in around 1978, when I was in the second to the last class of graduating from secondary school, that was when I started putting on hijab. You know, you feel as if you have committed a crime if you put on hijab, you know. And at that time, there was, nobody was putting on the hijab. Most people, they go almost naked with short dresses and so on.